Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. With more than 220 years of service to the nation, the U.S. Coast Guard is a military, multi-mission maritime organization that safeguards the U.S. economic and security interests. From the oil platforms of the Northern Arabian Gulf to the interior rivers to an increasingly open and accessible Arctic, the Coast Guard ensures the safety, security, and stewardship of our maritime domain. Demand for the Coast Guard's unique capabilities has never been higher. Facing new challenges has required it to organize more efficiently and manage operations more effectively. What is the U.S. Coast Guard's strategic direction? How will steadying the service make the U.S. Coast Guard ready for today and prepared for tomorrow? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Admiral Robert Papp, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard. Admiral, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure having you.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Paul Hempstead. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Admiral, before we delve into specific initiatives, could you give us a brief overview of the rich history and mission of the U.S. Coast Guard? As one of the oldest U.S. government agencies, how has it evolved into a critical component of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security?
Well, I like to describe the Coast Guard as a series of mergers and friendly takeovers over a course of two centuries. We actually started back in 1790. We were the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury. He did not have a navy. The country did not have a navy. The navy and the army were laid up after the Revolutionary War. And his idea, as a Federalist, was to fund the central government through collecting tariffs on maritime trade, knowing that this country, throughout its history, he projected, was going to be reliant on maritime trade, which is a theme you'll hear from me throughout the day. So in order to collect those tariffs, you needed some ships out there with law enforcement people who could work for the Customs Service to enforce this. So he created something called the Revenue Marine. It was in an act of Congress, the Tariff Act of 1790, and it authorized the construction of 10 cutters, which were positioned along the coast. Over the course of our history, the Revenue Marine, or the Revenue Cutter Service, as it became known, grew, expanded, and was really the maritime arm of the government. The War of 1812, the Navy had been constructed by the new Navy had been constructed by that time, and we have fought along and with the Navy for over 200 years as well. In 1915, there was actually an effort to discontinue the Revenue Marine, but people decided that it was doing its job so well that they would give it added responsibilities and brought the life-saving service into what became known in 1915 as the Coast Guard. We kept our military character, and during World War II, we added the Lighthouse Service, aids to navigation, and then the Bureau of Marine Inspection and Navigation, which gave us our merchant mariner licensing, ship inspection, ship safety responsibilities. So we've just added responsibilities and brought in these various other agencies into this service, which has grown throughout our history. Starting out in Treasury, moved to the Department of Transportation in 67, and then to Homeland Security in 2003.
So would you give us a sense of the dual mission of the Coast Guard, in particular the military and law enforcement mission? And how – the other aspect of it is, how is it organized? What's the size of your budget, number of staff, and geographical footprint?
Well, you know, I think the Coast Guard is rather – it's certainly unique for this country and unique in comparison to most countries as well. One of the things you find in our Constitution – in fact, it's called the Posse Comitatus Rule. We were abhorrent in terms of using military to enforce domestic law. The British had used their troops to enforce law. Our early founding fathers did not want that. So you will never see any of the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines enforce law. They may assist us. The Coast Guard is unique because we picked up this character in our culture very early. We were created as a law enforcement agency to enforce the laws of the United States on our waters. But early on, when our early shipping in the 1790s started being preyed upon by French privateers and British privateers. We were the only navy in existence, so we picked up that military character defending the country as well. Now, with those small cutters, we didn't do all that good. So in 1796, 6 years after our creation, was the Navy Act, which authorized the construction of the first six frigates, Constitution being the first one. So we've had this culture of being a law enforcement agency, but also in times of war, in times of need, working with the armed forces, actually being one of the armed forces, but being able to take on this dual role. We've got about 42,000 uniformed active duty people right now. We have 8,000 civilians, 8,000 Coast Guard reservists that we can call up in emergencies. And then we have this other unique organization called the Coast Guard Auxiliary, which is a volunteer organization. It's much like the Air Force has the Civil Air Patrol. We have the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and they volunteer their time, their talents, and their efforts, most of it teaching boating safety or helping us patrol regattas and things like that. But they're a force multiplier for us that costs the taxpayer virtually nothing. So we're very proud of them. Our budget, you asked about the budget, roughly a $10 billion budget, a little less than that proposed in the 13 budget, but we're all facing some budget constraints.
I'd like to transition to your specific role, sir. Would you tell us more about your duties and responsibilities as the 24th Commandant of the United States Coast Guard?
Well, I'm a service chief, and like the other service chiefs, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Chief of Staff of the Army, and the Chief of Naval Operations, our primary role is to organize, train, and equip our service to be prepared for the duties that the country gives us. There's one difference for the Commandant of the Coast Guard, though. Because of the move towards jointness in the Department of Defense side, as you all probably know, operations are carried out by the combatant commanders. The service chiefs organize, train, and equip, but the forces are transferred operationally to the combatant commanders. I'm the only service chief out of the five services that has command of my service. In other words, all Coast Guard operations are my responsibility. Now, in practice, that's exercised through two area commanders. I have two vice admirals. One is Commander Atlantic Area, one is Commander Pacific Area, and they carry out the day-to-day operations of the Coast Guard, but I still hold the responsibility for it.
Regarding your responsibilities and duties, what are the top three challenges that you face in your position, and how have you sought to address these challenges?
The top challenge is, how do you continue to provide the services that the American public has come to expect from their Coast Guard and, quite frankly, deserves? They share their treasure, their taxes goes into our budget, and they have rather high expectations. And we like to meet their expectations. But the challenge is, we cannot do 100% of all our missions on any given day. We have finite resources, only so many ships, so many boats, so many aircraft and people. So what I challenge those two area commanders to do is, they have to decide on a daily basis, what are the highest priorities? Let me give you just a quick example that illustrates this. When I was Commander Atlantic Area, I have so many ships that I'm allocated on any given day, and we're out there doing fisheries patrols, drug enforcement, alien interdiction. And then we had, a little over 2 years ago, the earthquake in Haiti. We had three Coast Guard ships in there the next morning to start providing aid to the people of Haiti. Now, we don't have earthquake response cutters sitting around. What we have is very versatile and adaptable Coast Guard ships that are used for many missions. But we decided, the country decided, aid to Haiti was the most important thing on that given day. So we diverted three ships from other operations. So we took a short-term deficit in drug interdiction, migrant interdiction, and fisheries in order to provide those ships to help the people of Haiti. And that's really what we do on a daily basis. We've got a wide mission set, finite resources, and we press operational decision-making down as far in the organization as we can, even sometimes to the chief petty officer level at some of our stations that we have. So we try to do everything. It's one of our strengths and one of our weaknesses. A lot of people are fond of saying we do more with less. Challenges that often comes at the expense of your people. So that's probably the highest priority. The second thing is, we embarked about 10 years ago on a recapitalization project, trying to replace our aging fleet and our aging aircraft. We've done pretty good on all our small boats at our stations. We've just about renovated our entire aviation fleet. But it's the ships that are the most expensive, and they are really the things that are in worse shape right now. Most of our major ships are in excess of 40 years of age, which 40 to some people, particularly a 60-year-old, 40 years doesn't sound too bad. But in ships, that's past senior citizen status. There are all kinds of systems inside, hull wastage and other things that just don't allow you to operate those ships as effectively as you would like to, and they become very expensive to maintain. The Navy generally plans on a 25-year service life for their ships. Coast Guard, unfortunately, generally runs ours about 40. The last thing, the third priority, is emerging missions, and probably the one that's foremost in my mind right now is our responsibilities in the Arctic. Shell Oil, and I think the permits are going to be approved by the Department of Interior, will start drilling up there this summer in the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea. I've been up there the last two summers to do some preliminary work with our district commander up there. And it's going to increase our responsibilities because there's now human activity in the Arctic in our waters that we're responsible for with no commensurate increase in our resources. So that's probably my third priority.
So, Admiral, you've spent a good amount of your career on the water. It's a unique experience being a sailor. Given your experience, what are the characteristics of an effective leader? And more particularly, how has being a sailor informed the way you're making your decisions as commandant?
You know, people ask these leadership questions all the time, and there's a lot of people that make a lot of money writing fancy books talking about leadership theory. To me, it's all seemed very simple. You're given a job, and you've got to get a job done through people. And some people are very good at it. Some people are marginal at it. Most people can get the job done, but it's all a matter of how motivated are your people, how well do they do it. So I think those are sort of the basics of leadership. And every leader should have clearly defined responsibilities, the authority to carry out the job, and then be held accountable either if the job is not done well and given the appropriate praise and measure of success if the job is done well. I sort of use those simple theories because that's sort of the way I was raised. All I wanted to do when I joined the Coast Guard was to go to sea and be a ship captain. I was fortunate to be able to get that opportunity for a major segment of my career, serving on six ships and commanding four of those. And it sort of formed my view of life and how things work, because when you're on a ship, if you're a captain, you quickly realize you can't get the job done by yourself. You've got to work through your officers, through your chief petty officers. You need to make sure they are all aligned with your philosophy and your goals and objectives, and then use them to manage the crew and your resources to get the job done. So it's sort of working through others. Even though that was formed through a career going to sea and looking at as a ship captain, I have found that those same rules apply whether you're on a staff duty, whether you're running a district, running a Coast Guard area, and I think they apply also across the board to businesses and other things. Some guy sent me an essay last night on leadership with all kinds of fancy diagrams, and I sent it back and I said, you got to simplify this. I couldn't understand it, yet I can understand simple concepts like authority, responsibility, and accountability, and I don't think it has to get more complicated than that.
What is the strategic direction of the U.S. Coast Guard? We will ask Admiral Robert Papp, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.